Hello, on this week's program, David Patrick Stearns profiles the late Italian-American composer Giancarlo Menotti. Susan Lewis considers an exhibition at the Institute of Contemporary Art in Philadelphia that looks back at Andy Warhol's first solo museum show in 1965. And Tom Keels looks at efforts to secure a future for the venerable ocean liner, the SS United States. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Giancarlo Menotti was one composer who didn't have to wait until old age or death to be appreciated. Quite the opposite, in fact. He started at the top. He went straight from the Curtis Institute to the Metropolitan Opera in La Scala and stayed there long enough to redefine what being at the top meant for an opera composer. Some of his best operas were premiered on network TV and Broadway, two of them winning Pulitzer Prizes. But the last 40 years of his life, up to his death at age 95 in 2007, were as compositionally poor as his early years had been rich. Was he out of fashion? In creative decline? Now, in Menotti's 100th birthday year, the Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns seeks perspective on this glamorous yet elusive figure.
Is it possible that Giancarlo Menotti reached a point where he couldn't invent opera characters as interesting as himself? His gallery of personalities included a woman too addicted to her telephone to let her boyfriend propose marriage, a mystic afflicted with stigmata, a cheerfully crippled boy who was miraculously cured, and a psychic medium whose fake seances are aided by a gypsy boy without a tongue. As Menotti became famous with works such as The Consul, A Mall in the Night Visitors, and The Saint of Bleecker Street, he was partying with movie stars, living with the equally famous composer Samuel Barber as a domestic partner, and later bought a Scottish estate while running around the world staging his operas, as well as various Spoleto festivals in Italy and Charleston. Periodically, he returned to Philadelphia in various incarnations. Some of his operas were premiered here. Some of his best stage directing efforts, including Tchaikovsky's Queen of Spades, were televised from the Academy of Music. But now that Menotti isn't here to stage his works to their best effect and galvanize attention with his magnetic personality, how do these early works hold up? Though a hit on Broadway in the 1950s, The Consul played to some empty seats at Opera New Jersey's Season this summer, but with a hearty audience response. Menotti's story of Kafkaesque bureaucracy is something that the company's chief executive, Richard Russell, had wanted to stage for years.
First of all, it's a great piece of drama. I think it's a timely subject. And I think that the way that he incorporates the music into the text makes it very present. It doesn't. One of the things that strikes me occasionally about operas in English, although not the great ones, but sometimes the English text sounds kind of precious. But in this work, I really feel like Menotti's found a way to really express the English text, the American text, really, and which is stunning in the fact that he'd only been speaking English for probably 15 years at that point.
I found Menotti to be very accessible, but at the same time, not overly simple.
Mark Oberthorn, the Philadelphia-based sound restorationist, was only familiar with Menotti's children's opera, A Mall and the Night Visitors, when he began working on a new series of original cast Menotti reissues that are coming out with considerable acclaim on the Naxos recording label.
One moonstone to make you sleep, one red coral to hear your woe.
His reaction to Menotti was much the same as audiences some 60 years before.
There's a directness, but it's a complex kind of directness. And there were some pieces that I particularly liked, for example, the violin concerto. I had never heard that, and it has become one of my favorite of all violin concerto compositions after hearing that. It's just such a gorgeous piece. There's so much lyricism in it.
Yet, in an indication of how badly Menotti fell out of fashion, Oberthorn often had to do some serious hunting to find the original recordings for digitization. The Consul had been done by American Decca, which was more of a Broadway and pop label, and had been bought by so many companies, who knew what was in its catalog. Even major Columbia label recordings by the Robin Hood Dell Orchestra, the summer version of the Philadelphia Orchestra, had been forgotten for decades.
You can see this in the recordings. There are a large number of recordings of his works that you see appear in the late 40s through the mid-50s, and then it drops off almost completely after that. And his coverage on record is very spotty after that. So you can gauge how he fell out of favor with the public and the critics based on how you see the recordings dwindle.
Menotti wasn't the only famous Curtis-educated composer falling from grace. Both Samuel Barber and Leonard Bernstein felt increasingly marginalized amid the experimental avant-garde. Composers who kept their feet on the ground justified themselves by taking on important subject matter. Bernstein duked it out with God in his Kaddish Symphony. Barber went deep into the brutal world of ancient myth with modern takes on Medea and Cleopatra. Menotti embraced socially relevant subjects that seemed not to speak so deeply to him. Oberthorn attended the premiere of The Hero in Philadelphia and remembers not the music, but its references to Watergate.
It was done at the time of the bicentennial, and it was a comic opera, and there were some comic references to the Rosemary Woods 18 missing minutes of tape in the Watergate tapes. It seemed to be, again, accessible. It was something that was easily understandable in English without the super titles in the Academy.
In his final period, Menotti took on historic subjects that were basically new operas attempting to masquerade as old ones. No bad thing had they turned out well, but they did not, and reflected badly on his earlier works. Were they really that good? Opera New Jersey's Richard Russell was among the doubters.
When I was growing up, he was still producing operas, so I remember Goya, some of those other things that really were kind of dire. And it does make you think, okay, were we right?
What happened to Giancarlo Menotti? Barber was no longer so much in his life as time went on, and lacking a close proximity to the more musically cosmopolitan Barber may have been a bigger loss for Menotti than one might think, as he suggested in this 1980 interview published by West Hill Radio Archive.
In a certain way, Sam was also one of my composition teachers. Because in Italy, musical education was still rather primitive in a certain way. And concerts in Italy were the repertory was very limited. And again, Lieder was, concerts of Lieder in Italy were very, very rare. So again, he introduced me to a whole world of Schubert and Schumann that I did not know. And for me, it was very important because in getting acquainted with Schubert's Lieder, it changed my style. For me, it was a wonderful experience.
A huge creative departure for Menotti was his most Barber-esque opera, Maria Golovin, from 1958, written about the same time as Barber's Vanessa. Typically, Menotti operas were full of external events. This one has a more Chekhovian approach, whose action is all internal. It failed on Broadway. Maybe it wouldn't have in the opera house. Later, in the occasional instances when Menotti returned to this Barber-influenced Schubertian mode, the feeling is also quite different. So often, even in Menotti's best operas, his music is extremely personable, but not very personal. You feel him pulling the heartstrings like a master puppeteer, but you rarely hear him reveal himself. As time went on, and the operas got worse, Menotti's music seemed to grow so impersonal that it could have been written by anybody. What was behind this? Menotti was fond of saying, "My life is an open book, but I don't leave it lying around." What that meant is that he maintained a haze of truth, the kind that had many possible interpretations. And then, from beyond the grave, Menotti surprised me. Some friends returned from hearing the opera star Christine Brewer at Chautauqua, New York earlier this summer with news of a recital that included the Menotti cycle Songs of Absence, written in 1967 for Elizabeth Schwarzkopf. I chased on a recording, and Menotti opened his heart before my very ears. There he was, writing about the impossibility of love, using nautical metaphors, such as, "My ship is rigged, but cannot sail." And that poses a bigger, but thoroughly unanswerable question. Would there have been more music like this, and maybe not so many barren years, had he lived in an era when his life could be an open book, period?
Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Many of Andy Warhol's silk screens have become iconic, images of things as ordinary as a Campbell's soup can label and as glamorous as Marilyn Monroe. But he also created superstar personas, starting with himself. An exhibition organized jointly by the Institute of Contemporary Art in Philadelphia and 12 art history students from the University of Pennsylvania focuses on one night in 1965 when art and celebrity collided. It was the opening of Andy Warhol's first solo museum show at the ICA, when an estimated 2,000 people showed up. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis considers That's How We Escaped, Reflections on Warhol.
It was Friday, October 8th, 1965. The ICA director at the time, Samuel Green, who died this past March, anticipated the opening of Andy Warhol's first solo museum exhibition to be an extraordinary event. Warhol was an art school-trained, successful New York City graphic designer who was trying to forge his way into the fine art world. For the opening, Green had sent out invitations adorned with a Campbell's soup can label, contacted the media, and put his own publicity machine into high gear. Green was, says ICA curatorial fellow Virginia Solomon, a marketing genius.
The way that Sam was able to use Warhol's work, but also sort of like the Warholian notion of working and the Warholian observations about the potential for art to be a popular culture event. There's sort of this perfect storm confluence that happened on this night that was as much, I think, Sam Green's publicity acumen as it was Warhol's artistic acumen.
Adding to the unusual nature of the evening, after a boom mic had fallen through one of the paintings during a crowded preview party the night before, Green decided to take down nearly all of the art to protect it at the opening. Sam Schnittman, one of the 12 University of Pennsylvania student curators of the current exhibition, focused his research on what happened that night at the ICA, then housed in what is now the Fisher Fine Arts Library, when Andy Warhol showed up, entourage in tow, with actress Edie Sedgwick on his arm.
About 2,000, even estimates range as high as 4,000 people show up at this gallery in an extremely small space. Normally, no more than 400 people could fit into it, but nevertheless, they all fit in there. And when they come, they're not there for the art, because there's no art on the wall. You know, there's a picture here or there, but they're there to see Andy and Edie.
Faced with a mob and only a handful of security guards, Warhol and his companions climbed a corner staircase, only to find that the exit at the top had been sealed. Trapped, Warhol and Sedgwick engaged the crowd from the top of the stairs.
And so Edie is dancing, and they were passing cans of Campbell's soup up to him to be signed. And after 4 hours, eventually, several grad students were able to axe their way through the ceiling, and they escaped through the library's rare book stacks over the ceiling and then out to where the police could protect them.
The sensational night, thousands of fans at an art opening without the art, marked a turning point in Warhol's career, says Virginia Solomon.
That Andy and Edie are able to hold their attention to the degree that they are signals the shift wherein the art object stops being the painting and starts actually being Warhol and the people that Warhol is able to make and put in the public eye.
This exhibition is the culmination of student research on that night. The 24 works displayed include sketches by Warhol, a blouse and a lithograph made with repeated images of S&H green stamps, and photographs of the preview party in the opening night. Sam Schnittman says many of those attending were Penn students.
But there's also a lot of the Philadelphia upper class who were there. So it was actually a really interesting sight to see, because you have all these students dancing next to all these upper class women in all these gowns, and these students are wearing jeans. It's a really big mix of people here.
Also in the current exhibition is a new work commissioned by the ICA. The staircase that went nowhere on which Warhol spent the evening is recalled by a new sculpture by artist Alex de Corte. A section of staircase is perched high on a wall.
I was thinking about the space in which he was trapped.
The stairs of the sculpture are overflowing with wildflowers, which de Corte painted with conditioner, shampoo, and soda.
They're actually fake flowers that smell fragrant, but they're plastic. And I think that sort of feels a lot like Warhol. You know, he was sort of a plastic idea of himself at that point, or the image of celebrity. And there's something kind of interesting about, like, the human bit of him, maybe hiding from, like, this superstardom that is his work.
After the ICA show, Andy Warhol continued to work and nurture his own celebrity, as well as those people he described as superstars. His gathering place in New York was his studio, dubbed The Factory.
The Factory was this crazy amalgam of people, from society kids to drag queens, but people also who came from money. There'd be, you know, like crazy kind of parties where all kinds of stuff would happen. People would do all kinds of drugs. It was this sort of cultural capital, if you will, that is getting produced through this factory.
Warhol made art from images in newspapers and other media. He made portraits of celebrities, from Elizabeth Taylor to Chinese leader Mao Zedong. Other subjects ranged from the ordinary to the horrific, as in his series of images of car crashes and other disasters.
He made in reaction to what he was seeing. So if it was soup that he saw every day, then he made something about soup. Like, I think for him it was really direct. You know, if the headline flooded the newspapers, he just observed it and then was saying that just to recreate it or to make it bigger makes you kind of reconsider it.
He befriended younger artists, including Jean-Michel Basquiat, promoted rock bands like the Velvet Underground, designed album covers for Diana Ross and Aretha Franklin, and brought others into the production of silkscreens, films, and other art. While he was criticized by the art establishment for mixing commerce and art, the way he worked, gathered people, and cultivated his own celebrity provoked new ways of thinking about what art could be, and paved the way for new expressions, like performance and video art, says Virginia Solomon.
The fact that Warhol was taking images from popular culture and using them as the, you know, basis for the paintings that he made was certainly a shift in terms of ideas about, you know, the artist is genius who comes up with always his ideas from, you know, his soul and his artistic connection to some eternal truths about humanity or what have you. And Warhol, by making these screen prints, was breaking away from that to a certain extent because he wasn't coming up with his material. But by highlighting the artist as something, like the artist personality, the artist persona itself as something that was made, he sort of pointed to another truth.
But what was behind the public persona, the trendy pop sensation? By all accounts, Andy Warhol, born Andrew Warhola to working-class immigrants from Pittsburgh, as a child was often homesick, where he collected celebrity photographs and ate a lot of Campbell's soup. The private side of the adult Andy Warhol, who was shot in 1968 and recovered, but who died in 1987 at the age of 58 from complications after gallbladder surgery, remains an enigma.
He has that famous quote that he says, if you want to know about me, just look at the surface of my paintings. I am the surface of my paintings. Everything that you want to know about me is visible there.
It was Andy Warhol who predicted, in the future, everyone will be world famous for 15 minutes. In Warhol's world, the commonplace and the fantastical, the whimsical and the somber, all become fodder for a society that continues to build an ever faster, ever bigger media machine. Andy Warhol personified the contradictions and possibilities of a celebrity-driven culture. An observer observed, an artist who becomes the art, and a public sensation who could attract thousands, even after his paintings had been taken off the walls.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. That's How We Escaped, Reflections on Warhol, is at the Institute of Contemporary Art in Philadelphia through August 7th. Shoppers at IKEA in South Philadelphia often gaze in wonder at the giant ship moored on the Delaware River across Columbus Boulevard from the giant Swedish furniture store. The derelict vessel sits amidst rusting warehouses like some sort of abandoned set for the movie Titanic. This is the SS United States, a luxury liner that ruled the Atlantic Ocean before mass air travel. Now WRTI's Tom Keels explores the legend behind this ghost ship and one group's efforts to try to bring it back to life.
When she was launched in 1952, the SS United States was the speediest, most powerful ocean liner ever built. The Big U carried nearly every celebrity of the 1950s across the Atlantic, including Grace Kelly and Prince Rainier, Dwight and Mamie Eisenhower, and the Duke and Duchess of Windsor. Although the SS United States sailed out of New York City, it was the brainchild of a Philadelphia-born engineer.
My grandfather, William Francis Gibbs, was the naval architect and marine engineer that designed the vessel.
Susan Gibbs is the president of the SS United States Conservancy.
He saw a ship launched on the Delaware River at the Cramp Yard, and, you know, this was when he was just a little boy, and the St. Louis it was, and just was so taken by this big ship launch that he later professed that he dedicated his life to ships at that moment. But then, you know, subsequently, beginning in 1914, he had a fantasy of designing the fastest ship in the world.
During World War II, Gibbs ran one of the country's largest shipbuilders, responsible for constructing over 75% of the American military vessels that saw service. After the war ended, he used his technical skills and official contacts to realize his dream of building the world's fastest ship. The SS United States was heavily subsidized by the American government, which had an ulterior motive for her construction.
It was not simply a luxury ocean liner, although it was certainly that. It was also a top-secret Cold War weapon, where it was designed to be a convertible troop ship able to speed across the sea for 10,000 miles without refueling and able to accommodate an entire division of troops.
Nearly 1,000 feet long and weighing over 53,000 tons, the SS United States was the largest ocean liner ever built. Her top speed, over 38 knots, 44 miles an hour, remained a military secret for decades. Instead of the traditional wood paneling and lush fabrics of traditional ocean liners, Gibbs, obsessed with fire safety, used aluminum, fiberglass, and the asbestos compound Maronite, wonder materials of the post-war world.
The story goes that my grandfather engaged in a pitched battle with Theodore Steinway over whether or not he could design a baby grand piano in aluminum. And finally, after Steinway agreed to douse a mahogany alternative in gasoline and ignite it, and it didn't really erupt into an explosive flame, that my grandfather acquiesced and the mahogany pianos were permitted.
The SS United States embarked on her maiden voyage from New York on July 3, 1952. She raced across the Atlantic in just 3.5 days, smashing the old speed record while using only 2/3 of her power. For 17 years, the Big U was the nation's flagship and a potent propaganda symbol. Everything about her trumpeted America's power and prosperity, especially to immigrant passengers leaving war-torn Europe for the New World. Stephen Ujifuza is writing a book on the SS United States called A Man and His Ship. During his research, he interviewed a refugee from communism who had sailed on the United States.
And he had fled East Germany, you know, basically with the clothes on his back. And he had managed to get a ticket to go over to America on the SS United States. And he said that when he saw those red, white, and blue funnels on the Bremerhaven skyline, that represented freedom to him.
But the Big U's days were numbered when jet flight became commonplace in the 1960s. Unable to justify the ship's expense, the U.S. government retired her in 1970 and eventually sold the vessel. Stephen Ujifuza sees the selling of the ship as the beginning of her downward spiral.
She ended up being stripped of all her furnishings in the mid-80s in a huge auction. And then in the early 90s, she was towed over to Turkey by another owner, who stripped out all the Maronite paneling and all the asbestos in preparation for a refit. But then that project didn't work out, so en route back to America, she was repossessed by Cantor, Edward Cantor, who brought the ship to Philadelphia. And that's where she's been ever since.
Beginning in 2004, the SS United States Conservancy began working with the liner's latest owners, Norwegian cruise line Genting Hong Kong, to find ways to repurpose the vessel. But in early 2010, the owners began to accept bids from ship scrappers. The nation's former flagship was on the verge of being melted down for trash cans and paper clips when in July 2010, Philadelphia philanthropist Jerry Lenfest came to the rescue.
I initially said I would provide $300,000 if they gained the rest of the money to keep the ship. And then I enlarged that to $5.8 million grant, $3 million of which would be used to buy the vessel. And the remainder would be to pay for her for insurance and the dockage fees for 20 months, which would give the Conservancy the opportunity to go out and raise the funds to restore the vessel.
The Lenfest gift enabled the SS United States Conservancy to take official title to the ship. The Conservancy has unveiled a master plan to make the former liner the centerpiece of a waterfront development which might incorporate a luxury hotel and retail space in addition to parkland and a museum. The group is currently seeking public and private partners in New York, Miami, or Philadelphia to develop what Susan Gibbs envisions as
just this jewel on the waterfront and a, you know, an iconic visual attraction as well as a real money-making entity for the city that gets her. There's certainly a road to climb, but I think the potential is enormous for the ship to really serve a number of different objectives, both historic preservation, but also economic revitalization, job generation, and, you know, it could really do it all.
While the SS United States is safe for now, its future is far from assured. The Conservancy must secure partnerships and raise the money needed to redevelop the ship at an estimated price tag of at least $200 million. That's a lot to accomplish between now and November 1, 2012. Until then, the world's fastest liner will remain at rest on the Delaware waterfront while embarked on a race for her life.
WRTI's Tom Keels. And that's our program for this week. You can hear an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at WRTI.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony and Sea under music director Rossin Milanoff. The program's associate producer is Eric Brannan. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.